You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Grevet.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Grevet. I'm your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we believe in a healthy, sustainable world, a world where our food is free from GMOs and harmful chemicals. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. And don't forget to confirm your email. Also, we are mostly funded by your donations. So if you'd like to donate, you can either donate on the show page or for a different amount, go to the main page and click on the donate button. Thank you. My guest today is Jonathan Latham, PhD. He is the co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, which is the publisher of Independent Science News. He has published scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, virology, and genetics. One of the reasons I wanted to have him on the show today is because I read his recent article entitled, How the Great Food Wars Will Be Won. This caught my attention, and today we're going to be discussing this article with him, as well as discussing the need for independent science. Dr. Latham, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol.
I'm really excited to interview you today and speak with you about several things. I had previously told our listeners that I wanted to discuss your article, How the Great Food War Will Be Won, which the title alone was so intriguing to me. But let's start out finding out a little bit more about you and Bioscience Resource Project and why you created Independent Science News.
So I did a PhD in plant virology quite a while ago, and I was researching GMO crops, right? We were making them in the lab, and then all of a sudden, you know, what we thought was an experimental technology came onto the market as a Monsanto product, and you know, quite a few people in our lab were quite put out by that. You know, we were quite surprised at that time. This is the early 1990s, and but that, you know, the kind of skepticism that many scientists had at that time about, you know, whether these crops really should go on the market was not ever reflected in the media or in the scientific literature. And so we saw a kind of discrepancy between the public statements of the companies and the general understanding of politicians and the public that was at odds, really, with what we considered to be expert opinion. And you know, to cut a long story short, what happened was that we published an article, a scientific article, that was skeptical of genetic engineering. But we couldn't get it. It was hard to get it published, for a start. And then once it was published, it was hard to get people to refer to it because, you know, the article was quite explosive in its implications. And nobody wanted to even refer to it who was writing a scientific paper. People didn't feel that they could even refer to things that were skeptical, if you like, of company positions. And so, you know, we realized there was really a big problem with science at that point.
So then you started the Independent Science News.
That's right. So this was, you know, quite early. This was 8 years ago when the internet was sort of, you know, just becoming a place where you could start a website without spending too much money and such like. And so we started our nonprofit project so that we could, the first thought we had was to put our paper online so that people can read it. And as soon as we did that, hundreds of copies were downloaded every month. But until we could do that, there was no way of giving people access to our research.
Okay, and on that website, which is independentsciencenews.org, you say that manipulation of science can be surprisingly easy. Why do you mm-hmm. think that is?
Well, science is it's very complicated. It's also it's hidden from the public, right? So, you know, you can have you know, decisions are made by single individuals, editors of journals and such like. And there can be, you know, as often there's no comeback for anybody. You know, it's a non-democratic process, if you like. And so it's happening, you know, there's lots of things happening behind the scenes that no one ever sees and that's kind of presented to the public as, you know, the normal process of science. But in fact, it, you know, I would argue it's very different.
Yeah, and you mentioned suppression of information and also manipulation of information.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two tactics that that are used. How do you think those are used? Can you give us some examples?
Well, I mean, when we, well, the there's something that we talk about in the article, which is to do with genetic determinism. So genetic determinism is the whole idea that if you become ill, for example, or if you are clever or you're not clever or you have an illness, that illness arises from within you. And that the whole theory that illness arises from within you is basically a contrast to the environmental, the traditional understanding that you are what you eat. And so this is an example of a scientific thesis that has basically gone from nowhere in the 1980s. You know, no one thought that people's health was determined by their genes, to in the nowadays, 2015, when most people, most of the time, think that if they get heart disease or they get obesity or they get Alzheimer's disease, it's probably because their parents had it. And so that is an example of a way in which scientific understanding has basically been manipulated by companies, but also by governments, to create a public perception based around, you know, there's complicated maths in there, there's complicated genetics, there's things that no one outside of those fields really understands. But it's been used to create a public perception.
So what you're saying is that rather that we're more focused on it's in your genes and that's why you're
mm-hmm.
getting ill, rather mm-hmm. than looking at junk food or pesticides or public policy.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yep.
So that's a manipulation. And I'm sure that's one that biotech companies are quite proficient at. Let's talk about your recent article of January 12th this year. And again, it's entitled, How the Great Food War Will Be Won. And the industrial food producers in the food system want us to believe that they can produce enough food for future generations using GMOs and these pesticide-laden foods. Thus, a non-industrial system of farming and organic methods and non-GMOs cannot feed the world. And this is their big PR strategy. And they also talk about how people who believe that GMOs are harmful are anti-science. And that
mm-hmm.
they're pro-science.
Mm-hmm.
And you give an you say, you know, you talk about when you can go to any of their websites, Monsanto, Cargill, Syngenta, Bayer, and they talk about how are we going to feed the world with this problem, and we have an expected global population to be, by 2050, 9 to 10 billion. So how are we going to do that? That's their big push for why
mm-hmm.
we need
mm-hmm.
GMOs.
That's right.
Why do you think so many people believe this?
Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we have supermarkets that are, where, you know, that are bulging with food and we all bring home food and it gets, you know, some of it gets wasted. In this country, there is a huge amount of excess of food. But if you read the newspapers, for example, you can see that there are groups like the World Bank explaining to people that there are, in future, you know, there's going to be more people. There's going to be, you know, more land used up by the spread of cities. There's going to be all these kind of crunch, if you like, of resources and such like. And there's a huge amount of public information out there that all is saying the same thing. And, I mean, I was reading an article in The Guardian the other day, and it was basically postulating there would be a food crisis, we'd all have to become vegetarians or maybe, you know, go short of food. And there wasn't even a discussion in that article that there might be another possibility, that actually there was plenty of food in the world. That possibility wasn't even considered. And that's a newspaper quite well known for its balanced journalism, but they didn't consider there was even any balance to be had.
So why does this strategy have a fundamental weakness?
The reason why it's a lie is that there are many ways in which we can produce more food if we wanted to. For example, a huge amount of the productivity of United States agriculture now goes to biofuels. And the same thing is true in the European Union. The same thing is true in South America. It's even true in countries like Indonesia. So these countries are basically, what they're doing is supporting their own farmers by trying to find new markets for agricultural products. So they want to make, packing chips, or they want to make disposable cups, or they want to make all these things out of basically food crops, because there is no way that the current population of the planet can eat all that food, right? We're producing just so much humongous quantities. But they basically want to support their farmers to keep the price high so that they don't have to, so partly to support agribusiness, right? But partly to support farmers and make sure that those people don't go out of business, because the farm lobby is very strong, for example.
Do we have a food shortage?
No, we don't. No, there's no way. We can produce more food if we wanted to. I mean, many of those crops are not high producing crops. Even when corn is used for human consumption, such as sweet corn, if you could grow, for example, potatoes instead and produce many more calories from those same areas. And also, a lot of what people eat are vegetables. For example, the vegetables of the United States are pretty much all grown in just a couple of states, right? It's very easy to feed, 300 million people sounds like a lot, but the land area of the United States, if you're actually efficient about it, could probably feed the entire world, the whole 10 billion people, if that's what you designed the system to do. But the system isn't designed to do that. The system is designed to make profits for agribusiness and to make profits for certain industrial-type farmers.
So it's interesting, you can see the manipulation, especially in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And many people are focused on believing that we need GMOs to feed the world, rather than focusing on this industrialized global food production, which is responsible for so many negative things like deforestation, marine pollution, greenhouse gases, and many more things, and the massive human health problems.
Yeah.
We're focusing on the wrong thing. And you also talk about how the public already mostly knows that, I like that mostly, because not everybody wants to believe this, that pesticides are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
They know that organic food is higher quality. They know it's environmentally more friendly. They know that GMOs should be labeled and that they're largely untested. Yet we don't have GMO labeling in this country, and people have voted against it.
They have.
Why?
Yeah.
In your opinion,
well,
why?
I do know. I think there's two reasons, probably. One is that the companies put a massive amount of money into those labeling, their anti-labeling campaigns. Tens of millions of dollars were spent in some of these states to defeat the public, basically the perception of the public. And a lot of those campaigns were not based on truthful statements.
Yeah,
and the
correct.
Other thing is that I don't think the campaigners did the right thing in focusing on the idea that you have a right to know. I personally think that the campaigners should have been more educative over the public and tried better to explain the hazards of GMOs, the hazards of pesticides, how pesticide use is becoming greater, and how companies are using the intellectual property around GMOs and the patents and such like to control the seed system and the food system in general. Right? So they see, GMOs are super important to some of these companies because they're using them to, if you can control the seed, then you can dictate how farmers grow their products. You can dictate what products they use down the line, the herbicide they use and the pesticides they use. And you can basically control the seed system, and you have the legal system in place so that if your seed gets spread into the wrong places, that you can sue those farmers rather than the other way around. So this, GMOs are the kind of launch pad for a control of the global food system. And that is the kind of thing that I think the campaigners should have tried to explain to people in their adverts, and that they didn't really do.
Okay. And you also talk about how the industry, which is the agri industry, understands how this all works, but you claim that the food movement really does not. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, public relations is a very sinister and dark art. You know, it doesn't come naturally to people who want, you know, freedom or justice or organic food or whatever it is. You know, it's something that you have to think about in quite a cynical way from the start. And I think it's counterintuitive. And it also goes against, one of the classic public relations issues is that you try to claim that public relations doesn't work, right? That people do things, for example, for money, right? So one of the industries claims is that, you know, people will do something if it profits their pocketbook, and they won't do it if otherwise. But a lot of public relations is actually based around the idea that people do things for quite other reasons than that. People do things because they're fair, or because it helps their neighbors, or because, you know, it's good for future generations, or it's ethical, or something like that. And that is where the food crisis myth comes in, right? It's that you convince the public that your business, your agribusiness, exists for an ethical reason, right? It's a very important thing. You know, people want everybody to be fed well. That's fundamental to them. And so they don't want to be supporting some kind of form of agriculture that will not feed people, because they feel like, you know, if I buy organic food, I'll be taking food out of someone's mouth, and that's not fair, that's not nice, that's not ethical. And so the industry knows that, but part of the industry, you know, the public relations industry spin is that PR doesn't work, right? The public relations is not a good way to manipulate people. And they tell their customers, you know, obviously that PR works, but they tell it all the rest of us that PR doesn't work, and that we do things for money. And that suits the companies, right? If companies, you know, if you are big businesses, you are Exxon or you're GM or you are Goldman Sachs, if you can tell politicians and if you can tell the public that everybody does things for money and you're the people with the money, then people have to do what you want, because that's supposed, you know, according to the rationale of our society, that's how people make decisions. But if it really isn't how people make decisions, they're also making important decisions based around ethics and fairness and such like. Then you can have it both ways, right? They can argue in public that they're doing their thing for rational reasons and for financial reasons, but really behind the scenes they're manipulating public opinion based on how they really know that it works. So it's a complicated thing, but that's why people have such a poor understanding of how the world works, if you like, because they're fundamental preconceptions of what is even how they're making their own decisions is not known to them.
Right. So you discuss how PR works with belief systems and and the manipulation of those belief structures with respect to, you know, a particular product or whatever their goals are. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you talk about is it works best when people do not know they are being influenced.
That's right. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's best that when it comes from a friendly source. Can you explain that further?
Well, a lot of, you know, companies are people take information from people they trust, right? If you're the kind of person who likes people with suits, or you wear a suit to go to work, or you feel comfortable with those kinds of people, you're likely to trust the information coming from somebody on TV who wears a suit. But you know, people who are hippies or punks or female or whatever it is, they often will take information only from those groups of people, because you trust those people. You know, if they wear the same clothes as you. And the same thing happens with institutions. So big companies have taken over important nonprofits like the Nature Conservancy in order to feed environmental information to people. So the Nature Conservancy and the World Wildlife Fund are one of the vehicles for this spreading the myth about the food shortage. Right? So many of us don't believe what we're told by Monsanto, But if we hear it from the Nature Conservancy or the World Wildlife Fund, we're likely to believe it. And so, but this is one of the principles of public relations, is to understand that different people have to get information from different sources in order to believe it. And that means the companies have to control, in a sense, those information sources.
And I was thinking of some of the ads that were out during the labeling campaign here in Colorado, and they, you know, had a trusted farmer who turned out to be a lobbyist. And
yeah, exactly.
If people would do a little research, they would have found that out. But they had a farmer on there saying, look, this is going to hurt us. It worked.
Yeah, it works very well.
It worked very well. One of the things you say is the task of anyone who wants harmony, justice, peace, etc. to prevail, therefore becomes primarily to free the people from believing in lies and thus allowing them to attain mastery over their own mind.
Mm-hmm.
Explain and expand on that a little bit further.
Well, one of the stories that I like to tell is about the Emperor Constantine. So he, a long time ago, he inherited an empire, the Roman Empire in 300 AD, that basically was falling apart. And he needed some kind of source of external legitimation, if you like, of his regime. And so what he decided to do was get the help of the early Christian church. And what the church had was they had the support of a supreme being. So the Roman Empire at that time was a pagan empire. There were all these backyard religions and you know, people had these little gods that almost belonged to themselves. You know, they were elves who lived in the garden or something. But there was no way for those, you know, if you told your neighbor that you were doing something because the elf in your garden had told you to do it, then that was fine with you. But you couldn't tell your neighbor what to do based on the presence of that elf or the information you got from that elf. But what Constantine realized is that if you have a monotheistic religion, which is standing behind the emperor, that basically the emperor then has the support of the supreme being of the universe standing behind him. And if you go against the emperor, then you become the person who, you know, essentially is hated by the supreme being, right? You're no longer lining up your philosophy and your ethics, etc., with the universe, in a sense. And so what he realized is that you could use that information to basically lie to people about, you know, he would tell people that the supreme being supported him being emperor and not anybody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
As far as we know, the supreme being never thought that. But because he had the support of the Christian church at that time, then he could tell people that. And so that became, you know, a fundamental lie, if you like, a misconception about the role of the emperor in that society at that time. And so you basically, you know, he filled the heads of the people with a series of untrue statements that basically supported his power structure. And he became emperor for 30 years. He scrambled over six other people, and they had six different emperors over the previous 6 years. But he became emperor for 30 years and set the scene for the whole church-state relationship that became to dominate European politics for the next almost 2,000 years. So he had he invented a structure, if you like, of the church and the state working together to provide information to people that essentially kept them suppressed, if you like, and so that became the basis for the political system of Europe.
Well, that's a wonderful example, and I think that this social engineering has been planned and used for eons, and that the ultimate solution is for people to become individuals who realize that they have personal power and can affect change by using that power. Only then will we be free from the control and manipulation.
That, yeah. that, I mean, that, 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 that is, I would totally agree with that. I mean, basically, The whole idea of the church at that time was that only they had an understanding of the will of the universe, if you like, and the
right.
will of the supreme being. And they, but at the same time, you're saying no one else does, right? You're saying only we know this information. And, you know, in my opinion, it's not true. We all have equal status in understanding how we think the universe works. And if we want to line up our lives with how the universe works, then we, you know, you can't tell someone else what to do, but equally no one can tell you what to do either. And so the power structures that we have, which basically allow some people to tell other people what to do and in certain circumstances and such like, you know, basically can all disappear, if you like. And if you understand the social structures and how those ideas come into being, then we can become free people, basically, finally.
Okay, so let's go back to the food movement for a few minutes. So how do we dismantle these lies? In your opinion, what does the food movement need to do?
Well, what I suggested in the article is that for agribusiness, everything depends on this feeding the world lie, that they are, you know, their system of agriculture is tremendously awful. You know, every single place where industrial agriculture operates, it is incredibly destructive. You don't hardly find birds in their fields, and if you do, they're all crows. So they cause a destruction of the soil because the soil runs out of carbon, you know, of organic matter. They cause, you know, the pesticides ruin the rivers, the fertilizers ruin the rivers and the seas, et cetera, et cetera. So when people, you know, when people in part realize how bad that agriculture is, they then start to ask ethical questions about, you know, whether we really need to be doing this or not. And so the other part of what needs to be explained, and that was the purpose of the article, was to say that, you know, is that we need to remove the general pervading understanding that there is an ethical reason for agribusiness. Because at the moment, agribusiness goes to Washington, and they get humongous subsidies to do what they do, and basically making the argument that what they're doing is feeding the world. And so, if we can make it so that that argument becomes, you know, a laughing stock, if you like, that no one believes that argument, and the evidence is surely out there, then their arguments in Washington or when they go to local state lobbyists or politicians to get more subsidies, when they appear in public, that their arguments are basically laughed out of court and they no longer can have the command of the subsidies and the politicians because nobody will speak for them because they don't do anything good in the world. And so we need to establish, you know, if you're a member of the food movement, you need to establish that concept. And if you do so, that industry will basically disappear.
And so you also show that famine is an empty threat.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that by switching to that focus, you know, it's just been a lie that has been perpetuated and the public has been duped. That's a great starting point. And what else do you think the movement needs to do?
Well, I mean, the point of my article really was that is all anybody needs to do. You know, you need to find a way to spread that information to everybody. You know, assuming that you can't just write it in the New York Times, because that's one of the organizations that spreads the myth in the first place, you have to find ways, you know, all your campaigns for organic or your campaigns for public education, they need to feature this concept and feature it prominently. And or labeling, you know, if you want to run a labeling campaign in your state, then you should mention in, you know, as many ads as you can or as many articles that you write as you can that the agribusiness, the famine concept, the idea of a food shortage now or in the future is basically a myth, and debunk that lie. And that essentially what will happen is the industry will evaporate because it will no longer have the arguments it needs to gather subsidies and such like. And I really think that is the only thing that is necessary. There are probably other ways, you know, you could elect green members to Congress or whatever, but, you know, that's not a prospect that we can eagerly see.
Yeah, I think there's been too many people placed into office that are pro-GMO already that I think it'd be difficult at this point to get somebody in there that would really have any valid influence on what I consider to be very corrupt organizations like the FDA and and the USDA. So in conclusion, you state that the necessary shift in perception is to see that, as in most wars, the crucial struggle in the food war is in the one inside people's head, and that the great food war will be won by the side that understands that and uses it best.
Yep.
Can you just elaborate a little bit more about that?
Well, the idea is that you don't need to go to Washington. You don't need to elect different politicians. You don't need to do anything except focus on essentially the ideas that you put out as a food movement or as a nonprofit who's campaigning for organic agriculture. If you want your organic agriculture system to prevail in the broad picture of things. So this is one of the practical difficulties here, is that, you know, maybe you're a person who is starting a CSA farm or something like that, and you would like organic agriculture to prevail, but especially you want to sell products to your customers. But, you know, your goal isn't really to change the agriculture of the entire country. You know, you're in some rural area of some state, and so you have there's a difficulty in that, you know, you can tell your customers, for example, that the food crisis is a myth and that they can come to you with a ethical, clean conscience. But there is a difficulty for small organizations to explain, to use this story, because it doesn't necessarily benefit them directly, right? So it's the idea is that if all it takes is to change people's minds, this is the understanding of public relations, is that you have to prepare people's minds for a change. And if you can prepare people's minds for a change, then they will accept that change. They will like it. But you have to prepare them for that change. But the advantage that the food industry has is that, you know, the grocery manufacturers of America, they run adverts all over the entire country, and they have members all over the country, so they can coordinate what it is that they say. And there's not necessarily anything in it for somebody who has a small farm or runs a small nonprofit or an anti-GMO organization in their state. This message doesn't necessarily make perfect sense for them to use it. But they should understand that if they do use it, their cause will prevail in the bigger picture of things. But people's actions, you know, the bottom line is people's actions are determined by their ethics and by their understanding of the world. And, you know, the actions that we see, you know, when you know, if you decide to drive to the supermarket or you decide to drive to a different store or to a CSA to get your food, there's, you know, that's the action that we see. But what happens inside people's heads is really where the action is. You know, if you want to change the world, that's the space where you have to do it, is inside people's heads.
Well, again, it comes down to being an individual, using whatever your individual talents may be, because we're all different, we're all unique, but if we realize how much personal power each of us has to make change,
and
we can do this. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Yep.
So, Dr. Latham, can you give us your website again so that people can go to your website and read the article and find out more about you and what you do?
Yeah. I think the place to start is our website called independentsciencenews.org. So it's all one word, www.independentsciencenews.org. And we have a lot of other stories about public relations or about issues in the food system that I think people will find interesting.
Okay, thank you very much. And thanks for being a guest on Food Integrity Now. I really learned a lot from this article and from our talk today, and I hope our listeners did too. And it certainly provided some food for thought, and we look forward to reading more of your articles. And we will be back next week with another great show, and thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Carol.